Yes, this week we're in for a bit of a treat, but I'm sure they've got the title wrong. In my mind, it was the last tram down Kingsway. I don't know about Clapham, I hadn't been abroad in those days. But this is one of my favourites that Spike and I wrote together when we had many hours laughing. Especially about the trams. Trams are comedy vehicles.
Come along, get off you. What?
And if somebody says you want a vehicle for the next show, I'd say tram straight away. And that's why I was committed.
Any more questions? Good.
Hello, and welcome to your weekly visit from the Goon Pod. My name is Tyler Adams, and this week we're talking about another Goon show. And I'm joined for the first time by a guest down under. It is Andy Bell.
G'day, how you going?
Andy, very, very good to have you on the show, and this must be a great disappointment to any fans of Erasure listening. You're not that Andy Bell.
No, you're not.
An Andy Bell.
And Andy Bell. I'm neither that Andy Bell or the ITN reporter.
Right.
I think, yeah. But I am an Andy Bell. I'm in Canberra, which Spike Milligan once described as Australia's federal capital, deep in the middle of somewhere.
Well, yeah. And I can attest to that, having lived there briefly in the early 90s.
But it's you're different here.
Yeah, but you're not an Australian born and bred, are you?
No, I've spent about half my life here. Came here in bicentennial year, 88. Before that, I was a bit of a bitzer, more than a bit of a bitzer, actually. Born in Lancashire, lived in the northeast of England, then London, then South Wales. So my one claim to fame really is I've been the Welsh language correspondent for the BBC in Australia for nearly 40 years. I do quite a lot of reporting for them from here. That's my claim to fame, yes. So, Dee Da, g'day from Australia.
I'm trying to think now, is there a large gathering of Welsh-speaking Australians in Australia?
Well, of course, New South Wales, Dee Cymru Newydd, came about because Captain Cook from Whitby sailed down the coast of what wasn't anything at that point, but it became New South Wales, and said, looks a bit like Port Talbot and round there. And it does. And strangely, when I moved here, I went from working for the BBC in Swansea, at Harry Secombe's hometown, to Wollongong, which is exactly that part of New South Wales. So it was like leaving Swansea and going somewhere else, except it didn't rain as much. And as for elsewhere, there were 40-odd chapels, Welsh-speaking chapels in Victoria in the 19th century because of the gold rush. And the one other thing that Wales was bequeathed Australia, weirdly, is the word Eisteddfod. You'll hear Eisteddfod's done a lot here as competitive galas for kids and young adults. Yeah. So, but there are no Welsh pubs, by the way. There are Irish pubs. I'm a member of an Irish club here. I'm a member of a Scottish club. But the only Welsh pub I have found in the Antipodes is in the New Zealand capital of Wellington.
Okay. So Andy, obviously you and I have been in contact for quite a while now, and you wanted to come on and talk about a particular Goon show, which is The Last Tram, brackets from Clapham. But I think it's easier just to call it The Last Tram, I think, now.
Yeah, and Clapham actually isn't involved in the radio program. Weirdly.
No, no.
It is in the Telegoons. There you go. I've got the T word in early there.
Oh, yeah, the Telegoons. Well, I didn't, I've done so much research. I didn't watch that Telegoons episode again for this.
Fear not. I have looked at it in the last 6 hours.
Right.
And It's interesting. They did quite an interesting rewrite of some. Spike was very good at recycling. Well, it's well, that's another issue we're going to talk about. I think we both know it wasn't Spike. It was Eric Sykes who wrote this. Anyway.
So what's your history with the Goon Show then?
Well, it begins with the Telegoons. I'm so sorry, everybody. Don't turn off, because I know some people have some very strong feelings about the Telegoons. But I was about 4 or 5 years old when the Telegoons were on. And they were just funny noises and funny-looking things on the telly at that time when puppets were fairly straightforward. It was Twizzle and it was Sooty and Sweep, whom I was a huge fan as well, Pinky and Perky. And I just liked it. That was underpinned by the fact that the Goons EP, the 1956 EP, you know, Ying Tong Song, etc.
Yeah.
My uncle had a copy of and used to play it to me on the Pi Hi-Fi at my grandparents' home. So I got to the Goon Show as a radio program through the Telegoons and through music, which they were the sort of entry drugs into the Goon Show, because by the time I came along and was listening to radio, Goon Shows on radio in the 60s were as rare as hen's teeth.
Yeah.
And ironically, had I been born in Australia, they were on every week.
Yeah, on the that's eight. Right.
So that's how I got there. And as I got older, 72, the last Goon Show of all, there was a lot of carry-on about that. The scripts came out. There was obviously the Parkinson and... From memory, there were reruns through the 60s, but only in clusters of a few at a time. And I think, frankly, as someone in their early teens in the late 60s, the Goon Show didn't quite chime. It's as I got a bit older and got A, the double entendre, and B, understood perhaps the military humour, which underpins so much of the Goon Show, that I warm to it, but I don't know about other people. It is a bit like a frog in cold water and the heat's turned up and you get to sort of more and more and more, except you don't get bored to death when you listen to the Goon Show. In my case, it was learning more and more about it, and even the great epiphany at some point where I went, you know what? I don't mind Max Geldray and Ray Ellington at all.
Well, there you go. That was going to be my next question, because I always ask, did you skip the music?
No, and I'll tell you why, and I don't want to deconstruct too much.
I think you'll find.
Interestingly, in this episode, they use the musical breaks as a furtherance to the, and I'm going to use a $10 word here, the exposition, because this is one of the joys of this episode. It is well constructed. Even the stretching isn't stretching. It's actually part of the plot, the repetition of things, a running gag, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's Eric Sykes, who's a craftsman. And this sort of collision with him and Milligan, we'll never know. I just feel there are bits of Milligan in it, but you just wonder whether they emerged in rehearsal, you know, on the Sunday morning. Who knows? When I started thinking about talking to you about this show, I went to the wonderful Genome Project online. Yes. And in the Radio Times, it's a Eric Sykes credit for the script only. But then I found a copy of the script, which had been sold, and it had both the names of Sykes and Milligan on it. So the mystery will never be solved, but I just feel the Sykes-Milligan relationship, I'm amazed no one's done a TV movie about it, because... Well, copyright, Tyler and Andy.
Yeah, well, that's a TV drama about Associated London scripts, even.
Actually, that could be a series. But you've got the great paperweight ashtray throwing incident between Eric and Spike, and more. And you've got good old Norma as well.
You said about the script. You saw the script online. Was that the script that was sold at Bonhams for £192?
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's got brackets, it's got Clapham in it as well. So as so much of the Goons, what's on paper and what actually equates to real life a reasonably accurate facsimile, but not always true, and that's good.
Yeah. I wonder as well, I'm sure I've read it somewhere. Years ago I read Eric's book and that, but I wondered how much involvement Eric had aside from actually writing the scripts. I mean, what I mean is on the Sundays, I wonder if he'd nip down to the Camden and sort of run through it with them or be involved at all or just watch them doing rehearsals.
That's interesting because off the top of my head, even after reading the about Larry Stevens and other stuff, there's a mist around the whole process, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, because Eric... There's also a little bit of a question mark over what it was that prompted Eric to stop writing on the show. I know Sellers supposedly complained about the quality of some of the scripts at one point, and I think that cheesed Eric off. Although Sellers then, I think it was the last show that Eric worked on, which was Tales of Montmartre. I think Sellers was on record as saying that was one of the best shows ever, or something like that. There's a little bit of... Again, there's so many questions left unanswered when you look at
this. Well, in this show, structurally, what's interesting is tried and true characters have multiple appearances, like a traditional kind of take it from here's get or Hancock's half hour. Mm. You know, Minnie and Henry appear three times and they're in somewhat at the payoff. That doesn't happen before. Moriarty and Griptype Thin are separated. And Moriarty and Bloodknock are a wonderful combination.
There, Moriarty. I'll pay pontoons only.
Pontoons only? We're playing chess.
I thought the cards were a funny shape.
Isn't it nice, though, that we guess a bit?
Oh, yeah.
Because there's all this information. I mean, the work that's done by the Preservation Society and in book form is extraordinary, and yet we're still going, what if, what happened there? Who was that? Why did they do that? But the notion of Eric there, I'm assuming it's 54, it would be in the Camden. I actually went to a few recordings of Friday Night is Music Night as a 9-year-old, ask.
Yeah.
Wonderfully warm house. It is odd, isn't it? Because Spike's, even if his name's not on the script, which is in Wallace Green's latest announcement, the tension there would put Harry Secombe's core diplomatique plate under quite a bit of pressure, actually.
What version of the show did you listen to? Because I listened to the fully restored original version as broadcast.
I've on the BBC Sounds one, which is over 30, with the most magnificent segue out of the end credits into Crazy Rhythm.
Okay.
I think that is stunningly good, with Geldray on the harmonica that could be a mouth organ and Ellington on the bongos. It's just... And Dickie Katz on the piano. It's just in total fantastic. And before I forget, it reminds me, one other factor in this particular show, this is a great audience. They're laughing rapidly. Okay, we think it's got a great structure. Okay, it's funny and all the rest of it, but it's a very warm audience. And the laughs are coming a bit like a traditional sitcom. This is only 54, isn't it? I had a listen back. There are a few early Series 2 terrible recordings on YouTube. And this is only 2 years later, and the difference is astonishing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like night and day.
No stargazers, thank God.
No. Well, even Series 4, the series before this, in the same year, because this is November 54, earlier this year, in 54, it was Series 4, there were shows that sounded, the ones that exist still, they just sound a bit flat. It's really, I think, it's weird. It's like Series 5 just began like a dog out of a trap or however you want to describe it, and never looked back, you know?
The alchemy. And it struck me as I was thinking about the audience and they're laughing at things that actually aren't funny on the page, but they're laughing at the language used of sound, of audio, like a signposted joke about a 49 and sixpenny phone call, after which is played a remarkable ringtone, including the Harry Lime theme from The Third Man. And then Seacombe says, answer that phone. That's not funny. It's funny, though, with what came before it. So perhaps the audience, it's attracting people to the theatre, whereas in earlier times, perhaps some of the audience were just getting their tickets from the,
The
BBC ticket unit, in the same way that led me to Friday Night is Music Night.
Well, it's like the early first series of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Absolutely.
The audience was bussed in from Croydon or whatever, and they had no idea what this show was. There was no sort of fan base that had built up. So, I think by series two, series three, the audiences were applying for tickets, So there was an atmosphere, probably the same year.
I talked earlier about, language, but there's a language to The Goon Show, and it's not just the language as written, it's the sound of it, and it's the lack of, it's the illogical logic to it. And if you're used to take it, even though Take It From Here was splendidly written, but frankly, if you're used to Life with the Lions or Raise a Laugh or Variety Bandbox, etc., Welsh Rarebit. I'd love to know what that audience looked like. Were they sort of beatniky kind of types? And I think probably overwhelmingly male. Were they people who'd served in the war? Were they national servicemen? And it's Sunday night as well. I mean, I have boozed up, are they, as well?
Wow, yeah. Half the audience is probably mates of Sellers, Seacombe and Milligan, and family. I know Dave Lodge was often in the audience. You could hear his laugh occasionally. Very distinctive.
There's some wonderful recognition laughter in there, which particularly at one point during a credits list for the faux documentary about the Last Tram, which is full of in-jokes, one in particular which we'll get to.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. Okay, so it's a show that I remember listening. I remember listening to it for the first time. And I didn't listen to these in order. I was listening to these as they were repeated on Radio New Zealand. In sort of, there was no particular order to them. So one week I might listen to a series 7 show, the next week a series 8 show, then a series 5 show. And I remember I can remember distinctly the first time I heard this episode, because it sounded different. It was quite atmospheric, and I remember thinking it sounded slightly different than other Goon shows I'd heard, particularly that, there's the bit where after the ceremony for the Last Tram, it goes quiet, and then there's a strange sort of metallic, wobbly sort of harp.
Ethereal.
Ethereal, that's the word. And I believe that is based on the sort of music that plays if there's a breakdown in BBC broadcasts. I remember hearing that and thinking, that I've never heard that sort of thing happen in The Goon Show before. That's weird. But it is based on real events. And I did take the liberty of doing a bit of research about the history of London's tram network.
Okay. Loving it.
A short history of London's trams. The first tram began running in 1861, and the last tram was in 1952. A slightly longer short history of London's trams. There was a time when London had the largest tram network in Europe. Ha! Take that, Lisbon. In 1861, an American businessman called, ironically, Mr. Train, started running a series of horse-drawn trams between Notting Hill Gate and Marble Arch, then Westminster Bridge to Kennington Gate. They were not ultimately all that popular with the public, however, and Mr. Train decided that ungrateful London had tried his patience, so he returned to the US and tried to become president. He didn't. Maybe he should have stuck to trams. It wasn't until 1870 that the idea of running trams in London again was nodded through the relevant committees and gentlemen's clubs, and so the Metropolitan Street Tramways Company sprang up, running horse-drawn trams from Brixton to Kennington. They ran on rails, and though pulled by horses, the passengers enjoyed greater comfort, a smoother, less bumpy journey than they would have withstood inside an omnibus. Some years later, cable tramways began. In 1885, a steam-powered tram was tried out, but was not a success. Wherever it journeyed, the air was rent with the sound of grinding and cranking, which drove everyone balmy. By 1900, there were over 140 miles of tramway in London, and the year after, the first electric tram ran between Shepherd's Bush, Hammersmith, Acton, and Kew Bridge. 5 years later, electric trams had all but replaced horse-drawn ones. It was the end of the horse-drawn tram. These electric trams ran by either a cable running above the vehicle or via a conduit below. Also in 1906, and very significantly, the Kingsway Tram Tunnel opened, running beneath the road from Holborn to Aldwych. It linked North London to South London, and special non-flammable trams were built to avoid fires. In 1909, two armed men, wanted by the Old Bill for a robbery, hijacked a tram in Tottenham and forced the conductor to drive it, the actual driver having had it away on his toes already. Police commandeered another tram and gave chase very slowly. It lasted 2 hours and covered 6 miles, with the villains firing 400 rounds of ammunition at their pursuers. There were quite a number of casualties, four fatal, including the two robbers themselves. This became known as the Tottenham Outrage. By the outbreak of the First World War, tram usage had peaked in London, with over 1 billion passengers a year across 3,000 trams. They were particularly popular with London's working classes due to the inexpensive cost of a ticket and their regularity, ensuring ragged-trousered workers could make it to the factory in time to breathe in noxious fumes and occasionally lose a finger. By the 1930s, buses and trolleybuses were gaining in popularity, and gradually trams began to drop services. By the end of the war, nobody was prepared to invest in trams anymore, so the writing was very much on the wall. There were rumours that the influential MP, Ernest Marples, had worked behind the scenes to finally inflict the death blow to London's ailing tram network. Could it be a coincidence that his family manufactured tarmac for roads and Marples was keen to promote driving? On the 5th of April 1952, John Cliff drove the last tram from Woolwich to New Cross. The week leading up to this historic closing of a chapter in London's transport history had been marked by several celebratory events. It had been called Last Tram Week. As driver Cliff applied the brakes for the final time, there was an official ceremony. The vehicle was mobbed by crowds of well-wishers, tram enthusiasts, and people with too much time on their hands, and the whole occasion was tinged with sadness and perhaps regret that it was the end of an era. And so that was actually the last tram. Well, since 2000, Croydon has been running trams again, but I think it's technically Surrey, so it doesn't really count. And now back to the show. Welcome back. So the first thing I'd say is that one factual error that I got wrong, or one fact that I got wrong, at least in that little short history, was the actual date of the last tram. Which,
but you're in good company.
Well, yeah. Well, I did a bit of research. Originally, I saw that, or I believe that it was July 1952 that the last tram ran. And then I listened to the show, the Goon Show, and it said, I think, 5th of April 52. And so I Googled 5th of April 52 and last tram. And certain sources suggest that the last tram did run in April 52. So I'm a bit confused, but from what you've said to me, it would appear that no, it was definitely July. Yeah,
that's what I've seen some newsreel, and it actually had, there was, as you said, the tram week has got dates from the end of June into July.
Yeah, it's weird how this, because there is information on the internet suggesting that April was the date, but more credible information that would say, that would put it at July. So it's weird, isn't it? But anyway, so this show, what was it? Why is it this? Why this particular show? What was it that made you want to pick on this one?
I think, as someone who's worked in radio and TV, both in the UK and Australia, I really enjoy, I'm going to use another big word here, so slap me, the deconstruction of radio as it was at that time. it's not just in jokes, it's the form. For example, the faux documentary, the back announcement. It's really well done. So I love that. I also love the fact that this is a show with a prologue, a first act, then Geldrow, a second act, then Ellington, a third act, and you could argue an epilogue, because you would think in a normal show, what does that mean? But in a regular show, oh, here's Blue Bottle. He's going to be deaded by the electricity wires being put together. But no, we were a couple of minutes away from the payoff, and the payoff is a proper payoff. And in the last few pages of the script build and build and build as a good traditional comedy half hour does.
Mm.
And it almost, dare I say, has the momentum of a tram or a train. There's a nice thing. I love the musical performances. I love the taking the you-know-what out of BBC announcer / Richard Dimbleby voice. I also love the fact that characters are used in ways to move the plot along, not to make their regular appearances. Because at times, there are certain Goon shows, and you were talking earlier on about later series, where they come in the same order, and you can almost mark it off your bingo card.
Mm.
And at times, and please don't at me, people listening, there are times when it feels like it's a 20-minute show that's being stretched.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't feel stretched, even though there's repetition in it.
Series 5, particularly with the advent of Eric getting involved with the scripts, there's probably the highest concentration of Goon shows with a beginning, middle, and an end.
Yeah. And I mean, aren't we lucky that we can sort of talk about this, because the whole thing from beginning to end is joyous. Even the last Goon show of all, it's joyous because we got a glimpse of what it looked like. It wasn't a radio program, it was a TV program. But that's by the bypass. But this doesn't let up, and there are lovely little moments, plays within a play, and there's some Minnie and Henry badinage, you know, we're all the way through. I mean, some really good, funny lines, not just two blokes on a microphone pulling faces, as I imagine they would do.
And as I stand here on the great pavement, there goes the last tram.
That was the last tram. Those taking part were the Mayor of Westminster and the councillors. And Adam Eagle led the Chelsea pensioners. Also taking part were the last tram driver, Norris Lurker, and conductress Madge Thund, leader Paul Beard. Produced by Menace Strain Bullshine, script by William Shakespeare, edited by Jimmy Grafton, additional dialogue by Giraldo. The hotel bill was by Gilbert Harding.
You said earlier about at the beginning of the show when they have this last tram ceremony, and Neddy is giving thanks to all those who took part. And this is an example of where, you know, I was, for the longest time, I grew up having heard the transcription services edit of this show. Mm. And so Neddy, obviously, he mentions the tram driver, Norris Lurker, the conductress, Madge Thund, and produced by, now I love this, Menace Strain Bullshine.
Yes.
No points for guessing who that could be. Script by William Shakespeare, edited by Jimmy Grafton. So nice little name check there for Jimmy Grafton. And in the version that I grew up listening to, Jimmy Grafton's name gets a big sort of whoop from the audience and a you know, cheers and round of applause.
Script by William Shakespeare. Edited by Jimmy Grafton.
But listening to the restored version, in fact, it's a line that was actually cut out, I believe, cut out of the actual broadcast version. So it's been put back in. It was recorded, but removed for broadcast. And Ted Kendall has managed to get this cut line and put it back in. So I don't know if you heard this on the version you listened to or not, Andy.
I did. And whoever's done the jigsaw puzzle has been a supreme user of the cutting blade, digital or otherwise, because these are references which are of the moment. And if I may tangentially mention, when it appeared, the same thing is done in the Telegoons version, it is refreshed.
You have been watching The Last Tram. Those taking part were the Mayor of Westminster, Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor, and of course the last tram driver, Norris Lurker, and conductress, Madge Thun, leader, Paul Beard, produced by Menon Strain Bullshine, script by William Shakespeare, additional dialogue by Ted Willis, Miss Thun's dresses by Miss Thun, wigs by bald people. Yes. Well, that's all for me, so... I see. Oh, I see, yes. Thank you. We appear to have a little time in hand before the next programme, so here once again is the name of the last tram driver. It is Norris Lurker.
Menace Strain Bullshine is still there. Paul Beard is there, which is a huge in-joke for the musicians, because this was a well-known BBC musician. But the additional material is by Ted Willis, the man who created Dixon of Dock Green, amongst other things.
Yeah, and Sergeant Cork.
So they were going for the kids in the early 60s. That. But William Shakespeare remained. And Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor got a Guernsey as well. For some bizarre reason, the White Heather Club was no doubt very popular at that point.
Right, well, because in the actual Goon Show that we're talking about, Seacombe says the hotel bill was by Gilbert Harding.
Yes.
And that gets the reaction from the audience. And I wondered, I was trying to find, you know, what is that? I mean, I was aware of Gilbert Harding, of course, but I wondered what that specifically referred to. Now, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, he was a tremendous bon viveur, I think is the nice way of saying it. There's a wonderful Radio 4 drama about Gilbert Harding. He was this, as only in the 50s it happened, these amazing larger-than-life figures who dominated the coming of television and maintained a presence on radio. Harding was on What's My Line, 20 Questions. Obviously, well, not obviously if you don't know about him, but if you find out about him, he was undone by a face-to-face interview, the same series that undid Tony Hancock.
Yeah.
But what he was as well was a public intellectual. You had these intellectuals, but he drank a bit. He was a closeted gay man. So the hotel bill, there's all kinds of connotations you place on that, but he lived a life and he liked to drop.
He did. And he was closeted gay, and he struggled to reconcile that with his Catholicism as well. And obviously, you know, you couldn't be out back then if you wanted to continue your career, generally speaking.
No.
But I think the mention of his hotel bill specifically might be, there's a couple of incidents that were kind of hushed up where, look, for example, there was an incident in Bristol when Gilbert Harding was involved in a loud, noisy argument with a young man he'd picked up somewhere.
Oh.
And one of his friends managed to go and sort this out and dealt with the management and dealt with the youth in question. And I guess money changed hands and it was kept out of the papers. And I gather there was a few such occasions like that in hotels. So it makes you wonder whether, you know, it was common knowledge amongst you.
It chimes, doesn't it? It really does.
Yeah.
And in that context of that run, the whole run, which has got a few more in jokes, like the reaction to Menestrain Bullshine is a lovely reaction. Mm. That is intriguing. And from what I know of Gilbert Harding, sounds absolutely, without going into the research myself, that sounds bang on.
Mm. And I love this. There's just little touches in this show as well. Little one-off characters like Mr. Clench that Sellers plays.
Yes.
Mr. Clench! Did you so much as call me, sir? Yes. Take your tongue off my boot. Some fool just phoned up and said there's still a tram at large in the Highgate Kingsway route.
Oh, but that is impossible, sir. All trams have been melted down and made into melted down trams.
Everyone?
All except the one you're living in, sir.
Wait, look. The tram map on the wall. There's still one flag pin stuck in it.
Good heavens. I had never noticed it before, sir.
What does it mean?
It means, sir, that there is a tram still running. According to the flag, it is a number 33.
When did he leave the depot?
1952.
He's running late. He's running terribly late.
Yes.
And there's also the new office person at the end that brings in the $20,000 that Bloodnock steals. That's again where it's a bit unusual. You're actually, and Harry doing quite a bit of his North Country act as the workman. And also, yeah, it feels a fully formed comedy script rather than a goon show. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense at all. It's got the goon show elements, but it's been honed. It's been crafted a bit more than sometimes, because there were times, particularly towards the end, where the memory and the recollection were being indulged by audience and performers alike. I think it's fairly fair to say. Not to say there weren't great good shows, but sometimes it was a bit of coasting and they knew that blowing raspberries or just stretching a bit would get them there. Immediately after that run, Tyler, is one of my favourite bits, and it is Beyond the Blue Horizon, played by the band under Wally Stott, Angela Morley, in the mode of a pit band of a variety theatre. And the pausing between each rendition is musical, because it adds to the humour. You can almost feel the audience going, what the is going on here? And then they get the joke.
It's the rule of three, isn't it? It's the rule of three.
Exactly right. And then Dear Bill, who had amazing comic timing, because at that point all announcers had to know about music and many of them studied music and all the rest of it, when he goes, we appear to have a little, which was something you heard a lot of even into the 60s. I think it's one of Greenslade's greatest, and I will use the word, performances.
Yeah. Yeah. In the Radio Times listing for the last tram, there's a truncated summary, which, like you suggested earlier, had sort of passing acquaintance with the actual plot.
Well, even the names are a passing.
But I managed to get the full little sort of précis, and I'll just read that out now, just because it's quite interesting. It says, so when driver Fred Crint and Clippy Hillary Boot drove the last tram for the ceremonial closing of the Kingsway subway, Ned Seagoon of the redundant tramways department thought that all his troubles were over. But a mysterious phone call put him on the track of a tramcar still at large somewhere in London. How did driver Henry Cron and Clippy Minnie Bannister eventually prove that they should have had the honour of driving the last tram? And what happened when excavations were being made in a new block of flats in Kingsway? And how did Major Bloodnock suddenly become Mayor of Westminster? So, yeah, more or less that's the plot or part of it. But then, yeah, the driver is Fred Crint, whereas in the show itself, it's, was it Norris Lurker?
N-O-R-R-I-S-L-U-R-K-E. Yeah, it is, that is fantastic. And this sounds like I have got nothing better to do. I ran the stopwatch on this show. It's over 7 minutes before you get to any characters other than Neddy.
Mm.
That is solid setting up the show, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love the I'll use the word architecture. I love the architecture of this episode. It's really well done.
Yeah. That's probably, you know, I said earlier about how it sounded different, particularly the beginning of the show. That's probably what it is as well. Probably the fact that there's no regular characters apart from Ned.
They're all there, but they play their parts, you know.
I mean, there's nobody in the first 7 minutes. That's right.
And you've got this Dimbleby voice of Sellers. You've got your mate Mr. Clench. You've got Miss Throat. You've got Ellington as Gladys.
Take it easy, you mad fool.
Your car's ready, sir.
Thank you, Gladys. Now come along, drive along the old 33 route and hurry, man.
Right, hold tight. Get up there.
She's running well tonight.
Yeah, considering we got a load of ashes on board.
Yes.
Get up there.
Take it easy, you mad fool. You want to kill us both?
No, only you.
Good. Stop here, Gladys.
We mentioned Spike there. You've got a little bit of information about Spike and Woy Woy, is that right?
Yes, Woy Woy. His mum and dad, Leo and Flo, migrated to Australia in 51, and Desmond, his brother, shortly thereafter. Now, Woy Woy, which Spike described as the largest above-ground cemetery in the world, is an area of Australia called the Central Coast. It's in New South Wales. It's to the north of Sydney. And he came back a lot. It appears he was somewhat estranged, perhaps, after they went. But, of course, in those days, a bit like when I first came in the late 80s, it was aerogram territory. He did make phone calls because it was very expensive. And he wrote up, he came back and he got to do shows for what was then the Australian Broadcasting Commission, which became the corporation in 82. Full disclosure, I worked at the ABC for 20 years.
Yeah.
And here's where the story really starts, is that bits of this episode were recycled into a thing called Idiot Weekly.
Yeah.
For an episode about the King's Bridge saga, which was a scandal in Melbourne in the 60s. And the one good gag that survives into as well as plot into that episode is all the trams have been melted down and made into melted down trams. But that sounds a Milligan line to me.
Yeah.
Does it sound that to you?
Yeah. Yeah, it does, definitely.
The mystery thickens.
Yes. And also with Spike, halfway through the show, he appears in his own voice, or sort of a posh variation of his own voice, giving kind of exposition to the audience and then saying, you must watch these points. And
a very nice running gag there.
Yeah, but normally that kind of running gag would be introduced more or less after Greenslade's opening announcement. You know what I mean?
Yes. And they all do an announcer style. Nettie presents the tram ceremony. Sellers does a Dimbleby voice. And Spike does an announcer voice. And Greenslade gets to be a bit cheeky with Blue Bottle. It's got a wonderful architecture, but there's a bit of anarchy going on within those walls.
Yeah. Greenslade... I mean, we're going all over the place with this, but right at the end, Greenslade sort of does a Blue Bottle act. And Blue Bottle in the wings is incensed and shouts, "I'll get you!" He shouts, "I'll get you at playtime with Terry." Yes. Now, it's just a throwaway line. I'll be honest, I'll hold my hands up here. I spent about 20 minutes yesterday trying to find out what that could be a reference to. And at first I thought, is that a reference to Terry Scott, perhaps? Mm. But I checked, and Great Scott, it's Maynard, didn't begin until the following year. And I don't think Terry Scott was particularly well known in 54. And in the end, I think it's possibly maybe just a reference to Spike. In other words, you know, Terence
Miller. Correct. I think you're right there.
Mm.
I'll tell my dad. Greenslade was from Wallasey or around those parts.
Yeah, I think so, something like that.
So a little bit of his North Country coming out. Tell my dad. I mean,
yeah.
I'm just in awe of Greenslade. I think there's an Edinburgh Festival show based on Wallace Greenslade.
Yeah, well, it's such a weird. There's such a lack of, relatively speaking, a lack of information about Greenslade. And he died so prematurely, of course. And of course, there's rumours as to how the circumstances in which he died and all that sort of thing, which I'll brush over now. But it's such a shame, isn't it, that he could have gone on and done bigger and better things, potentially. But no, he more or less died with the end of the Goon Show.
And he was a big star. I mean, he was on telly reading at the time when telly was getting big. Yeah. There is a haunting moment of him, I think, in that documentary from the late 50s, This is the BBC. Perhaps, you know what? I said, oh, it was an Edinburgh Festival show, or someone should make a drama about Sykes and Milligan. Perhaps we shouldn't know these things and just let it play out between our ears, because we clearly have those imaginings, and they're quite lovely imaginings.
Mm. Just staying on Blue Bottle as well, he makes reference to Alan Ladd in the Black Knight film.
Which is a shocking film by all accounts.
Yeah, well, it had only been out a month. It was released in October 54.
Yeah.
And it was British... shot in Britain with Alan Ladd as the title character, the Black Knight. And it's got people like Peter Cushing, Patrick Troughton, Lawrence Naismith, John Laurie. But the reason I mention it is that I noticed this lovely little sort of recollection by Donald Sinden, who was then a contract star for the Rank organisation at Pinewood. And his permanent dressing room was in the same block as Alan Ladd's. And I just want to read this thing that Donald Sinden said. He said, Ladd brought in his entourage, a double come stuntman who bore an uncanny resemblance to him. The double did all the long shots, most of the medium shots, and even appeared in two shots when the hero had his back to the camera. The star only did 11 days work in the entire film. He was extremely short in stature, and unless he was alone, the camera could never show his feet, because if he was stationary, he was standing on a box. If walking, the other actors were in specially dug troughs or ditches, and for anything between, all the other actors were required to stand with their legs apart and their knees bent.
And putting their fingers in their ear and going ting-a-ling-a-loo. Oh, my Lord. Because he was notoriously short.
Yeah.
Yet he was a hero. My brother is 10 years older than I am. And he was a big hero. My brother would have been in 54, would have been 6, 7. But this film sounds so bad, it must be sought out.
I've seen Shane. Shane was all right. He was in that.
Shane was translated into Welsh and dubbed.
Was it?
Fun fact, just before S4C came in the Welsh Channel, HTV did 3 dubbed films, and one was Shane. And it was a scandalous thing because they got an actor to do it, it's no longer with us, called Robin Griffith, who did it a bit camp.
Right.
What do you credit? Get either the money you've had, Vanama? You can write what's on it. Die whiskey. Mi brynys di ddiod i mi'r tro dwythau. Rwanta mi brynau.
Yeah, we're getting really meta now. My goodness.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
Get your I want to, getting back to The Last Tram.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that one.
And Gritpipe Thin in Series 5, sometimes he's collaborating with Moriarty, sometimes he's not, as in this episode. And there's a reference to him being married because he's the chairman of the Country and Town Planning Society, and he's awarded the construction of a new block of flats to his wife's brother.
Presumably been married. That's a bit of a shock. Wonder what Gilbert Harding might say.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think of any other references in the Goon Show's history to him having a wife. I'm sure there probably are, because neither Milligan nor, I guess, Eric in this case, you know, were particularly bothered about continuity or, the characters' backstories. But also the fact, you know, we've got the civic corruption because 10,010 is submitted and it goes to his wife's brother. It still resonates today, doesn't it? It still goes on.
Absolutely. And there's also an anger against government in this. You know,
he's a civil servant. Hit him.
Bang, bang. Hit him. And he gets a laugh. And, of course, we're in post-war. The war's been over 9 years. These flats are emerging from bomb sites and all the rest of it. That is a fantastic thing. That totally passed me by. And it gets a good, the dropsy gets a bit of a joke, but it's more a grip type. It's a joke. It's a situation comedy joke, which is grip type. Thin and Moriarty are not sitcom. They are and they aren't. They're ahead of their time. And
Mrs. You'd expect it. You could totally expect this in a sitcom, like you say, television sitcom, with, I don't know, Raymond Huntley and Richard Wattis.
And Avril Angus and Meg Jenkins.
Dropsy. He mentions Dropsy. I always thought Dropsy was an old-fashioned name for an illness or something, an old-fashioned illness.
It is. It's also a bung, I think.
Ah, okay.
As we would call it in the Antipodes, but they're bung it, but they're brown envelopes.
Yeah. There's another dig at, because around this time they're having a lot of digs at Churchill.
Yes,
with Sellers doing the voice, talking about the telegram on a couple of shows. In fact, last episode of Goon Pub we talked about that. Because Gritpipe sends Seguin to Bloodknot because Bloodknot will do Cut Price Lord Mayor. and
corrupt.
Absolutely. He calls Lou, Sellers' Jewish character, to hire the ceremonial robes. But apparently Winston wants them also. So he's getting a lot of stick, isn't he?
Yeah. Again, another sign this is more what you call a traditional show, but within the Goon Show world. And as I talk and think about it, and you talk with me, my admiration for this program only actually grows. Because I was always a bit concerned coming on here about halfway through going, oh, it's not quite as good as you think it is it? I think this is. But no, they rarely, really disappoint. They rarely Can I tell you something as well, just before, because we got up to where Blood Knot gets involved and all the rest of it. There's a wonderful moment where Harry goes full Swansea, where he says, "The crew refuse," and he starts cracking up.
Yeah.
It's very Ryan and Ronnie. It's very Ryan Davis as Mam in Our House. I don't know if people remember that comedy show in the early 70s, Ryan Davis and Ronnie Williams, which started in Welsh and then went into English. Bill Cotton Jr. hated it, but it was a surprising ratings winner because they had this skit of Our House and Ryan Davis was dragged up as a Welsh mum and she would say things like, "If there's anything I hate, I'm fed up. That's what I wish." And she would say, "Refuse," in that very Swansea Valley, which was where I went to university and where I worked for a while as well. And I'm very much a Swansea City man still. So that warmed my cockles. They were the Morecambe and Wise. They were deliberately created as the Morecambe and Wise of Welsh language entertainment. Some people might scoff at that. They got huge audiences, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Light Ent in UK in languages other than English is probably a PhD ready to be written because there's a lot of it.
Well, we'll have to fit that in with the Edinburgh show on Wallace and Spike and Eric.
That's right. That's three projects I've got to get cracking on, isn't it?
The bit you mentioned there of the Seacom going all Welsh, it's kind of like it's a fluff almost. He fluffs but just carries on going, doesn't he?
"You can't build the flats on the Kingsway subway."
"Can't build? But I've already had the dropsy from the..." Why not?
"There's a 33 tram down there."
"Well, get it out."
"I want to. I've got to. But this crew refuse to drive it until they are afforded another last tram ceremony."
And he knows he's fluffy, but because it's got that EW, so that crew refuse. Yeah. And it's not refuse, it's refuse, which there might not be much difference, but it's very funny to me, and he finds it very funny. Mm. And incidentally, in the next week's episode, The Booted Gorilla begins with exotic music and Wales, glorious Wales. I do love Wales, but you rarely see them in the fish shop these days. He had a very interesting relationship with his native country, Harry Seacombe, I think, without getting too political about it. Involved, obviously, with HTV, sang a lot of Welsh songs and all the rest of it. But I spent 10 years in Swansea. I can't ever remember him visiting, but I may have a faulty memory.
His voice doesn't, certainly in the Goon Show, he doesn't sound Welsh, and he doesn't sound his. I suppose when you hear him interviewed, you can kind of hear the Welsh, but it's almost like he softened it quite to the extent that he's kind of, it's almost accentless.
And I wonder whether he wanted to avoid getting involved in what was the Welsh rarebits, those kind of very, indeed to goodness, look you kind of shows that were on the Light programme. He did play a teacher in a film called Sunstruck.
Oh, we've covered
it. Which was filmed in Australia at Parks, where The Dish was also filmed, and The Dish also was, which is another dreadful film. But perhaps he had a complicated relationship. Perhaps it's a Facebook, it's complicated relationship with Wales. But, I mean, he is Ned of Wales. But a lot of the time he's talking about England, Ned, isn't he?
Yeah.
So that's of the time.
No, we covered Sunstruck, last year, I think? And what's his name? Harold Evans, the character. And he's from the Valleys, isn't he? And he goes to this godforsaken part of Australia and ends up rubbing shoulders with Derek Nimmo right at the end.
As you do in Outback Australia. It's got echoes of Hancock, who, of course, came out to Australia to do a series for the Seven Network as a £10 pom kind of thing, a belligerent £10 pom, and didn't live to see the end of the series. I worked with a couple of guys who worked on that show.
Oh.
And one of them was a gopher for Hancock, which basically meant making sure he either didn't drink too much or when he was getting demanding, he was given exactly what he got. But what I got from a guy was his go from one of the studio people was it was a very interesting, difficult project, as you probably would expect. I mean, he was a man who was about to look into himself and unfortunately take his own life.
And of course, who brought Hancock back to the UK? Do you know?
I do not know.
Willie Rushton.
Dead set. Wow.
Yeah. Hancock died, and I think Rushton was either out there already or on his way out there because of the cricket, I think.
Yes, he was a big cricket fan.
And he was... Or he agreed to accompany Hancock's remains back to the UK.
Goodness.
Anyway,
back to the tram.
A bit of a downer there. who's your favourite character or characters in the Goon Show?
I would say Bloodknock.
Okay.
I grew up around men who had fought in World War II and with uncles and grandparents who had fought in World War One. So Bloodknock chimed. I also like Cryptype Thin and Moriarty when they are really on song. I think they're pretty variable, but when they are really at the top of their game,
yeah,
because there is... Can I say the word sexual tension on this podcast? There's a tension there between them, which is... they share the same dustbin.
That's true.
So I'm sorry, Blue Bottlers and...
Green Sladers.
Green Sladers, no. He is a character, isn't he? So I put Green Slade in there as well.
Yeah. Well, okay, if we're talking about sexual tension in the Goon Show... Minnie and Henry, what's going on there?
Well, she is having a smoke on the top floor of the tram, which is a very good joke, but which would fly by most people today. Yep. In the olden days, Tyler, when we had double-decker buses where you could smoke on and double-decker trams and trolley buses, it was on the top floor that you would smoke and not on the ground floor of the vehicle. So and that
immortalized in the A Day in the Life, Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. And but I'm having a smoke. Well, she was also, we don't quite know whose bed she was in either this episode. Yeah. It's all happening, isn't it?
At one point, Seagoon refers to Min and Henry as Michael Dennison and Dulcie Gray, who they were a married couple, both actors. And they were both 39 at that point. I checked.
Really? Oh, because they, for me, were always sort of 65. And they were, they were amazingly... I'm going to give you a Willie Rushton moment. Did you know that their last stage tour was with Eric Sykes?
I didn't know. Right.
1995, two of a kind set in a retirement home, which I'm sure played at the Hippodrome Stenchmouth or wherever to total indifference. But they were old. But this was the thing in those days. People were old and they weren't old at all. But I guess wartime, diet and all those kind of things. But that's a very funny line as well.
The thing is, it implies that, because of course Minnie and Henry aged, it implies that Dennison and Gray are similarly aged. But I looked it up. Dulcie Gray's last role on television was an episode of Doctors, for God's sake, this century,
God love her.
And I only knew Michael Dennison mainly from the Anthony Asquith. The importance of being earnest.
Yeah, beautiful. I think we now have tangential proof that Minnie and Henry were, at least in the sight of some gods, man and wife.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I love Clippy Bannister. I love that's a lovely little thing. Clippy Bannister.
Minnie, take the beds down.
I can't.
Why not?
I just got in.
Well, stay in bed now you're there. Just bring my bed down.
Which one is yours, Henry?
The one I'm not in, Min.
Which one is that?
The one I'm not in, Min.
But you're not in either bed, Henry.
Thank you, Michael Dennison and Dulcie Gray.
It just careens towards this conclusion of the Black Mariah awaiting Tigoon outside the tram tunnel via Bluebottle deading himself, via Wallace Greenslade threatening Bluebottle's axe, which is a terrific bit of dramatic tension. Mm. A return of Beyond the Blue Horizon, which for the fifth time of asking, and the comedic chops of those musicians in terms of what it sounds like and also what they contributed to the audience. Amazing. Then I just like, it's got plot. Committee or no committee, I'm driving this tram out, jump on Greenslade on second thoughts, jump on the tram. It's plot and it's a joke. Fab.
Yeah, and you mentioned you watched the Telegoons version. So how do they, as I say, I'm kicking myself, I didn't watch it again, but I have watched it previously, of course, but remind me, how does that compare?
It goes straight in with the grip type thin character as doing on the whatever the date is in April, which we may or may not be the last tram day. We're going to make a special program. It includes, hold on to your chair here, Tyler, live action. There's actual pictures of trams. Wow. Now, how much that cost, I don't know. But there you go. And then there is, and I was referring to it earlier, the way that this episode uses the language of radio. The Telegoons intelligently uses the language of television, because instead of saying, we seem to have some time in hand, is the phone goes and Riptide takes the phone and he's doing one of those yes conversations when things go wrong. And they cut to the chase. Those taking part, we've already heard about and all the rest of it, but they add Miss Thund, that's Madge, the Clippy was dressed by Miss Thund.
Oh, yes.
And wigs by bald people, which grips like that. There's a pause and he goes, yes. And the phone call is brilliantly done, the 49 and 6 penny phone call. And you see one of those push button A, push button B old-fashioned phones. Mm. And the joke, instead of whistles and the Harry Lime theme and the flatulent donkeys and the Führer, is a hand putting money into the slot. And there's a little placket, a little notice in the phone box which says, pull chain for information.
And a real hand, I take it, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, Neddy escapes, chased up a hill. There's like an outline of a tram. And you see Neddy riding on the back of a tram. And a Black Mariah follows it up. And then they lose traction and they go backwards. And at the end, they say, well, what happened? And we see a picture of a block of flats. And guess where Henry, Crun and Eccles are? They're in a lift on the outside of a block of flats, which is an even neater way of completing the episode.
Yeah.
With a bow.
Well, that credit there to Morris Wiltshire, who presumably
absolutely
came up with that. Yeah.
And I, as I say, I think it stands alone. I mean, I have a as I said right at the beginning, a very warm feeling towards the Telegoons. But I think this is done really well, and it reimagines it. It's the remake, and very well. One thing I would like to mention as well, it's coming back to this country, Australia, is that the Goons were on ABC radio with the I think 105 episodes of Transcriptions, which were on bizarre rotation, as in New Zealand and other places. Yeah. When I first came here, they were on at 12:30 on a Saturday, which is a really good slot for the Goon show. And then in 2004, in January, some idiot decided to take them off air. They were back on air within 5 months. There was absolute uproar. And they got placed then at 5:30 in the morning, which I know to many people going, that's a terrible slot. Australians get up early, and they still got a big audience. I used to work with the guy who made the decision to take the Goon shows off air. And I was at lunch with him literally last week, and I said, Gordon,
wow,
how important were the Goon shows to Radio National on the ABC? And he paused for a moment, and he just looked at me and went, Andy, they were very important. And I felt perhaps it was a decision that might still play upon his mind. But they continued on ABC radio for quite a few years after that. The trouble was, in that slot, rather than a weekly slot, they were in a British comedy slot. And I'm afraid when the Goons are in a bracket that includes My Word, My Music, I'm sorry I read that again, and The Navy Lark, the Goons can only hold that programming block together for as long as they can.
Mm.
But obviously Spike is still thought of here. I mean, there's a wonderful ABC doco from the 70s. Spike Milligan takes a young look at Australia, which is rather interesting. And the BBC made a doco in the 80s from Woi Woi to Wagga Wagga. And then, of course, there's the Anne Spike Milligan newscast on ABC radio in 1971, which got somebody disciplined could only have happened, having worked for the organisation for 20 years. It was a fairly straight-laced organisation when I started working for it. In the 70s, it was effectively a public service department. But these are the things, when they go wrong spectacularly.
The news in brief. The Prime Minister, Mr. McMahon, arrived back in Australia today after his overseas tour. He told newsmen at Sydney Airport that he could not have had more valuable discussions with both President Nixon and the British Prime Minister, Mr. Heath.
What about Spike Milligan?
But he refused to give details of the discussions before he had spoken in the House.
What about Spike Milligan?
Mr. McMahon also refused to comment when asked about criticism of him by two former ministers, Mr. Gorton and Mr. Killen.
And Spike Milligan?
The Prime Minister was met at the airport by his two children
and
members
Milligan.
Of the Cabinet, including the Treasurer, Mr. Snedden, and Spike Milligan. Australia's national international airline Qantas has been awarded a trophy by the British Guild of Air Pilots and Navigators for its safety record.
And 33 crashes.
Qantas is the second Australian airline to win the Cumberbatch Trophy. TAA won it in 1958. The Australian Post Office is doing good business in the United States.
What? I've heard him as well. When he spent time here, he had a bit of an Aussie twang as well. He had a great deal of affection for this country, and quite what his role was in this program, I don't know. But as a member of the cast, I think it's one of his most consistent performances, actually.
Absolutely. He even does unusually for Spike, really, in the Goon show, he does a Jewish character at one point.
Yeah, I mean, these are different times, and those things are a bit awkward. Mind you, Spike had his own issues with Eric again in the late 60s with a program and controversial program called Curry and Chips, where Spike played a Pakistani of Irish heritage. He was of his era, as am I, as are you, and it's wonderful that we're all brought together by this extraordinary phenomenon.
Absolutely.
Can I leave you with just a notion that I thought about the other day? You've almost got the perfect mix of the three major characters. You have Sellers, who became an international star, so that gave longevity to the thing in one way. Milligan, an eccentric, that, forgive me, but the British love an eccentric.
Yeah.
And Seacombe, who became a national treasure.
Yeah.
What an amazing combination.
Yeah. There. Yeah. And of course, what about the early days with Benteen? Do you think Benteen was predestined to leave early, or do you think, you know, would if things had been different and he'd stayed with the group, what would the dynamic have been like, do you think, ultimately?
Oh, I mean, listening through that awful audio haze of the show, that to me, I can see a through line to later Michael Benteen shows and Square World and Potty Time and those kind of things. Mm. It sort of doesn't fit. And three is rule of threes, Tyler. Rule of threes. And the other little bits, the 1% and the 5% gelled. No Andrew Timothy, but Wallace Greenslade. No stargazers, Ray Ellington and Geldray.
Mm.
And you wonder, though, at that point with Menestrain Bullshine as the producer of those early shows, they needed producers who were a bit different as well. I mean, the road not taken for the Goon Show is so many roads were there. Thank the Lord they took them, and my goodness, didn't they turn them into boulevards of fabulousness?
And of course, yeah, and you think about it, Stanley Black was the conductor in the early days as well.
Yes, yeah. I think Angela Morley, Wally Stott, and I've heard her talking about how she got the gag, and of course, they were all musical.
Yeah.
Spike and the Trumpet, the ABC doco, which is on YouTube, which is called Otis Specials. Spike Milligan Takes a Young Look at Australia. You see Spike playing the piano in that particular cue kind of style. Mm-hmm. Seacombe, obviously. But also, you know, Sellers, the great drummer, and ukulele.
Yeah, yeah.
Music played a very important part, and it wasn't just the musical interludes. It without that knowledge of music and tempo and pitch and all the rest of it, it would not have been the same.
And the free-form nature of jazz and that sort of thing.
Got it. Bang on. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, well, listen, the next time you and I meet, we'll be rehearsing for Greenslade with an exclamation mark, the musical. And have you got anything to plug or anything?
No, I don't have. I am on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Welsh pun. I am on Twitter at @OrbechOz. Orbech means from afar. My name is Bell. You see where I'm going there? @OrbechOz. And I try and be nice, as you do, as much positive stuff and clips and weirdness as well. So if you're a fan of Icelandic situation comedy or...
who isn't?
Who isn't? Mm. That's the place for you. But I've got nothing to plug.
Brilliant. Good to hear. With that, Andy, I just want to thank you very much for your time, and we will speak again.
Thank you so much, and keep doing the great work, and it's been a blast.
I'll get you at playtime with Terry.
Tell me, Dad.